21 at 3:11 p.m. Today we have two bills on our agenda. That is House Bill 139, and I don't have my glasses, so I can't.
179.
And 179, and after we deal with these two bills, then we will begin discussing. And then while it helps.
You're welcome.
But anyway, 139, 179, and then we'll go back and work on House Bill 143. So first, we have House Bill 179, and we have Mr. Tom Wright from the Committee of. Good afternoon, Mr. Wright, and welcome to the House Resources Committee. We'll get things squared away here in just a minute. We will not be on teleconference until we start on House Bill 143. So with that, this bill before us is Committee Substitute House Bill 179, the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, an act to provide for the issuance of annual state park developed campsite free use permits for disabled veterans. My sponsor is the House Special Committee on Veterans Affairs, of which Mr. Wright is the senior staff member. So if you would, please, Mr. Wright.
Thank you. Excuse me, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always a pleasure to be before this committee. This bill is not very complex. It's pretty simple. It was introduced by the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs as a priority of the disabled American veterans. What it does is allows these Department of Natural Resources to issue free of charge annual state park developed campsite permit to a disabled American veteran. And that's the thrust of the bill. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. Cindy Roberts from the Department of Natural Resources is here, as is Jeff Morrison from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
You said somebody was here from DNR?
Cindy Roberts.
Oh, Cindy. Well, first let me ask, are there committee members' questions of Mr. Wright? The bill is rather self-explanatory. Vice Chairman Lincoln?
We're not on teleconference.
No, we are not on teleconference.
What was the, let's see, one is the CS. What is the difference between the 179 and the CS?
The difference is basically a change of language in the last sentence. We felt in the original House bill, the last sentence was kind of awkward and not too self-explanatory, so we worked the language around in the last sentence so it made a little bit more sense. No substantive changes at all.
We merely deleted, I believe, in fact, of the application.
Mr. Chairman, I.
Representative Lincoln?
How many, do you have an idea how many disabled veterans that we have in the list?
Mr. Chairman, according to the Department of Motor Vehicles in this state, there are approximately 350. That's the number we have according to numbers, you know, people who get disabled license plates. About 350.
How many do we have of that are, would be in the veteran category?
Well, that's what we'd have is 350 disabled veterans.
Disabled.
Disabled veterans.
But I'm talking about how many veterans, not disabled, but how many veterans. Do you have any idea?
You know, I don't think we have a number on that, and I would have to defer that to Jeff Morrison of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, because I'm not really sure.
Well, one thing we should add probably is that we do have per capita the highest number of veterans in the entire United States, per capita. So there's more veterans within our population per capita than any other state.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Morrison just informed me that we don't have an official count, but the count we do have or approximate is about 70,000.
70,000 in the state of Alaska? That's a good question, thank you.
Representative Lehman?
Thanks, Chairman. Tom, is it possible or that we could restrict this to resident disabled veterans? Or is that something that would not be, or maybe it'd even go counter to the intent here, because maybe a number of non-residents are coming to the state of Alaska? And if I could just add one more onto that, you can respond. And if not so, if it would not be appropriate, would we have comedy with other states or reciprocity to where they would allow the same thing in their campgrounds with Alaska residents going to theirs?
Mr. Chairman, we did discuss making it a resident issue only, and there seemed to be some illegalities in doing so. I'm not a lawyer by any means, so I don't even want to attempt to get into that, but it's my understanding that we would have some legal problems if we offered it on a residence basis. As far as reciprocity, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, that I couldn't answer.
Additional questions, follow-ups?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was somewhat in the order of the previous question. I have a couple questions in connection with that. It provides a system for applying.
Right.
Is it envisioned that this permit would apply as a year-round permit for the full year? A yearly permit, is that the idea? I didn't see it in the back.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kearney, yes.
And so if that's the case, the likelihood of a person who lives out of state getting that application applying would probably be narrowed down quite a bit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kearney, I believe so. I don't really feel, and this is just, you know, a personal belief, that first of all, we have a limited number of campsites available that are handicapped accessible. There's very few in this state, and I just don't see where we'd have a great number coming up here of people taking advantage of this, of disabled veterans taking advantage of that. In the state, yes, I could imagine that we'll have an adequate number of people taking advantage of it, but from the lower 48 now.
Please continue.
You talk in terms of handicap, but the bill only speaks to disabled.
Disabled veterans, but I should have rephrased that. Thank you.
But that's part of my question. There are quite a few, I know quite a few people who are considered to be 100%, 80%, 90% disabled who are as active as normal as you and I. I just wonder about whether or not where you make the break, how much disabled, 20%, 100%, or handicapped. It seems to me that there's a lot of room in there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kearney, we did discuss that. Disabled American veterans suggested 50%, but the feeling is if we started looking at a 50% disability, if we started looking at a 40% disability, this would require a lot of paperwork for the department to handle, and so we made it a disabled veteran issue, period. Try and lessen the paperwork.
Well, see, are there other questions?
No, I'm just chuckling at his haste.
What is there to say?
Yeah. Yes, so what is the pleasure of the committee regards House Bill 179?
I'd like to unanimous consent of the House to report the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? House Bill Committee Substitute to 179, Military and Veterans Affairs, moves from committee with individual recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Next, we'll have House Bill 139. Do we have someone here? Yes. You must be Kathy
Denadia.
Okay, Ms. Denadia, can you please identify yourself for the record? I will state that, for the record, that we have been joined today by Representative Moyer, Representative Lehman, Vice Chairman Lincoln, Representative Kearney, and Chairman Davids. Please continue, Ms. Denadio.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Kathy Denadio. I'm here for Representative Brown. She's unfortunately in another committee. The House bill before you is a committee substitute for House Bill 139 from the HES Committee, Pollution Prevention and Recycling Recognition Awards. CSHB 139 would provide for the public recognition of pollution prevention, waste reduction, and recycling efforts. Specifically, the legislation would, one, establish an Alaska School Recycling Awards program. Subject to available funding, DEC would be authorized to award grants of up to $2,000 each to public schools in recognition of their waste reduction and recycling efforts. To authorize DEC to identify, document, and publicly acknowledge exemplary pollution prevention achievements by individuals, businesses, or government agencies. And three, authorize DEC to accept contributions from private sources to fund the recognition awards. Each day, Alaskans produce approximately 3 to 5 pounds of solid waste per person. Each year, it is estimated that the state produces as much as 1 billion pounds of trash. Many communities throughout Alaska are confronted with a landfill capacity shortage and require substantial capital investments to address. The Department of Environmental Conservation has identified the needs for tens of millions of dollars and additional investments for new landfills and to address solid waste management problems. At the same time, new federal landfill design requirements are making the development of new landfills increasingly expensive. Last legislative session, the legislature enacted a statutory hierarchy as part of House Bill 478, see Alaska 4606021, that promotes solid and hazardous waste management practices in the following order of priority. 1, waste source reduction. 2, recycle of waste. 3, waste treatment. And 4, waste disposal.
Kathy, if you're reading the statement, perhaps in the interest of time, we could just, if you prepared to answer questions or additional remarks, because I think we have these words in writing.
Okay, that's fine with me. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any additional remarks that you would make besides what you have here?
No, other than that Representative Brown feels it is really important that we offer incentive awards, and that it is important that we try and train future adult Alaskans to reduce waste and recycle in our state.
I certainly agree. Are there questions of Ms. Donadio by members of the committee? Representative Moyer and then Representative Lehman.
We are in teleconference.
Did we get hooked up?
Yeah, we're hooked up.
So, yes, we are in teleconference. Welcome people out on the teleconference network. This is the House Resources Committee. We are, in fact, discussing committee substitute for House Bill 139 from Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. And we have now a question coming from Representative Moyer and then Representative Lehman. Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question may be better directed towards the DEC representative, Mr. Mock. But I'm very much interested in support of the bill. Under Section 2, how would the department go about identifying, documenting, and publicly acknowledging achievements by individuals, et cetera? What would they do? I understand they don't give a cash award like the other sections.
Right. They would be working with the Department of Education to set up regulations that would, and standards and criteria for the recognition awards. Mm-hmm. And basically it would be looking at criteria that's defined in the bill as to the population, access to recycling centers, any number of different criteria as to how effective the program has been in the community and the effects that it's had in the community.
I may continue.
Please continue, Mr. Representative Moyer.
Thank you. With the Department of Education, you said the regulations would be in conjunction with.
Well, they would be consulting with.
Because of the educational aspect, but also just public recognition. The reason I bring it up is there's a business in Fairbanks, as an example, that very recently, in fact, we passed some citation earlier this session, had some actions that I thought were very exemplary. They, in fact, paid their employees not to drive to work. They, to encourage walking, carpooling, bicycling, and in their case, mushing to work, they actually paid their employees $3 a day not to do so. And they figured they must have saved at least 1,000 gallons of gas from being burnt up into the environment. They were rather enthralled with their success, and in fact, they're looking at other measures. There are other companies in the other states, for example, that actually pay their employees when staying in hotels a sum that they're to pay the maid to tell them not to change their sheets, believe it or not, to save the water and to save the phosphates. So there are these kinds of things, and I think they can be best picked up by others if you recognize those companies that do them. And I would sure like for this to be the first one to suggest to DEC that this outfit receive some kind of public recognition for it. So therefore, I was asking, I wanted to make sure that they would be able to, right, to do so. And maybe Chet can go and answer that. That's a long question.
Right. Mr. Chair, I would move that DEC probably would be able to do that. I think the bill tried to set up some criteria, but left it up to the discretion of DEC to determine what the exact criteria would be.
Additional comment? Did you have a follow-up?
No, I just...
Yeah, maybe when Mr. Maher comes up, we'll let him address that question. Representative Lehman?
Kathy, I am on the Anchorage Hazardous Materials Commission, and in that capacity, we recognize exemplary, I think, either businesses or individuals each year who have done, you know, outstanding things similar to this, and I know that the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce has just started with, and I forget what they call it, an environmental committee or something like that, that does similar things, and I think this is probably good. Do you see this as being different from some of those? I mean, maybe the state doing the housekeeping seal of approval as opposed to some of these other functions. I just want to make sure that we're not sort of infringing on what some other people have sort of already started and are doing, or do you see this as being separate from and building on that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the intent of this bill is we wanted to include businesses and individuals in recognition awards, but the actual monetary amount would be awarded to schools, and we looked at that as more, we would like, I think Representative Brown would like the state to support waste reduction and recycling efforts and have it come out of the legislature, and that she also believes that the monetary value would be incentive, especially for schools, which we're directing the bill at, so that students today get used to waste reduction and recycling tasks throughout their everyday life and grow up with those skills, because we are faced with any number of problems. So I think this is more a complement to the already existing awards programs that are out there, but takes it a step further in terms of the awards to schools.
Okay, I'll accept the answer. This is just a little bit different, but I work in environmental engineering, so you know, I don't want to get too technical on this, but one of the things that happens in the whole environmental protection arena is that many times you get caught up on certain levels of protection, excuse me, and without recognizing that sometimes additional levels may actually cause greater use of energy or maybe because of secondary environmental effects, a greater effect on the environment maybe somewhere else. Like, you know, you may have a plant that manufactures lime or ferric chloride or something like that, maybe elsewhere, discharging its exhaust into the air, but in the meanwhile, if you take those chemicals and apply it here, at this particular situation, you may supposedly reduce the output somewhat. Is there some way of recognizing that? I mean, the net environmental benefits as opposed to, you know, maybe the one that you can just draw a circle around, this one unique element, and if you're taking into account some of these secondary effects. I mean, similar is the, you know, the argument over disposable diapers versus cloth diapers. You know, one could argue the case either way, but I don't think it's obviously clear that, you know, one is better than the other, although some people would have you believe that. Sort of philosophizing a little bit, I don't want to be too leading, but anyway, I'm just expressing some of the challenges that I've seen in my work, and just wondered if you thought about it.
Mr. Chair, in response to you, Representative Lehman, I think their intent also, again, on this bill and placing that, the responsibility primarily in DEC's hands to determine standards and criteria, is keeping that in mind, that DEC, that is part of their job, is to assess environmental impacts. They tend to have a lot of information. I believe Jeff Mock might be able to deal with this question a little bit more thoroughly than I can, but Representative Brown has faith in the Department of Environmental Conservation to come up with adequate criteria and be able to work with schools to develop programs for waste reduction and recycling, keeping in mind the concerns that you're expressing.
Any additional questions? Please note for the record that we've been joined by Representative Finkelstein. Cindy, thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Jeff Mock, if you would please come forward and identify yourself and who you represent. We'd like to take your testimony or your statements.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Mock. I'm the chief of the Solid and Hazardous Waste Management Section for the Department of Environmental Conservation. We support this bill. We're engaged in a number of pollution prevention projects right now aimed at primarily hazardous and solid waste. These projects are educational and technical assistance in nature. We believe that the public recognition, and in the case of schools, the monetary awards will be an additional step that we can take and will be very helpful to us in promoting pollution prevention, waste reduction, and recycling throughout the state. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Are there any questions for Mr. Mock? Question for Mr. Representative Moyer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Jeff, more or less a repeat of the question earlier, how would you determine what is an exemplary pollution prevention achievement, and how would you identify, document, I'm using the words from the bill, identify, document, or publicly acknowledge such? How would you go about that? What would qualify, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Moyer, it's certainly going to depend on who it is. If it's an individual, that individual may be community volunteer efforts. If it's a very large industry, certainly it's going to entail much more than that. I think we would be looking at trying to develop a formal recognition program that may be, since it's not monetary, it may have to take the form of simply a plaque or some other type of award like that, either from the commissioner or possibly from the governor, that people could hang on their wall. We could give them public recognition, of course. I think what we would be looking for would be to accept nominations from people statewide. Certainly we get a lot of information when we go out and visit companies. Oftentimes in the course of doing technical assistance visits, for instance, people will tell us what they're doing or come forward with what they're doing. We often learn when we're giving classes and other educational type workshops about what people are doing. So we would be interested in gaining this information from people in the form of a nomination and then deciding who has made the best efforts.
If I may continue, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, Representative Moyer.
And the public recognition is important, and it's gratifying for them to get a plaque, and it should be part of it, but likewise or simultaneously, some kind of public, something so that the rest of the public can learn from their achievement, like companies that may want to replicate what they heard through your program, ABR is doing. I forgot to mention they do several other things. They reimburse time spent volunteering for environmental organizations. They're allowed to take so many hours off a month to work for environmental organizations. They have to pay. They'll match donations to organizations. They're doing several other things like that. And I think that's the point of not just recognizing, but you could be building a database in your Earth Savers Pollution Prevention Program. Somebody called up and said, I'm a business, how can I help? And we hope you can build it. Some kind of database from that. Here locally, we've got Taku Smokeries, who's recently went to recycling their styrofoam boxes. And that's just maybe a small thing in relation to some others, but just a step.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moyer, we are very interested in that. In fact, we've done that in terms of technical assistance visits for many businesses so far, taken their names out and tried to make them a little more generic in case they have proprietary processes or don't want to be identified, but to write up an audit report, basically, something like that can be used, we can distribute. We've done that for many industries so far, photo finishers and vehicle repair shops being a couple of the ones, so that other people can learn from their experiences.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions or comments for Mr. Mock? I would just add to what has been stated that I think it's a very good bill. I think, if we don't start learning about the consequences of our own acts, if we do not develop an environmental ethic, a consciousness as well as a conscience, and those kinds of things start very young, then I think we're going to probably not live to see millennium keep producing some of the hazards that we do. But at any rate, Mr. Mock, thank you very much for your testimony. And next, I'd like to call on Mr. Devin Jones. Is Mr. Jones here? He did not make it. Okay, next I'd like to go to Tom Turner on teleconference in Anchorage. Are you there, Mr. Turner?
Mr. Turner is not here, but Audrey Lee from ALPAR is here.
Okay, Ms. Audrey Lee, if you would please come forward and state your name for the record, who you represent, and give us your testimony, please.
My name is Audrey Lee. I am the Executive Director for ALPAR, and ALPAR stands for Alaskans for Litter Prevention and Recycling. And we support House Bill 139, particularly as it relates to waste reduction and recycling awards for schools. We find that everything that has been said about starting recycling habits at an early age is true. And not only does this carry into their adult life, but it's also brought home to their families. This has been shown to us through our Can Do Kids program. The youngsters that are involved statewide, and there are over 6,000 that are involved in the Can Do Kids program, have brought this ethic home to their families and gotten the whole family, as well as other friends and relatives, involved in recycling. You might be interested to know that along with DEC, ALPAR has updated some educational tools for the classrooms that are made available. They can be obtained through DEC or the Department of Education.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lee. Does that conclude your testimony?
It does, and thank you very much.
And thank you. Next, I'd like to come back to Juneau and ask if Ms. Diane Stevens, did you have comments on House Bill 139? Thank you. Okay, next I would like to go to Mr. David Vandenberg. Mr. Vandenberg, are you here? After Mr. Vandenberg, we'll return to Anchorage.
Hello, my name is David Vandenberg. I'm with the Alaska Environmental Lobby. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for allowing us to testify today. The Alaska Environmental Lobby supports HB 139. We believe that 139 complements ongoing prevention, reduction, and recycling activities by acknowledging and encouraging success cases. It also gives schools the opportunity to create and implement recycling programs. As stated in HB 139, waste reduction and recycling are indispensable components of any successful solid waste management program. We harmonize with the bill's findings that public education is essential to ensure the present and future success of these activities. Public recognition of exemplary participation in these programs is a constructive means to encourage sustained participation. Our only concern is that the funding for the programs may not be enough. They've already endured a loss of over $30,000 this year. The Alaska Environmental Lobby hopes that funding for HB 139 will not be reduced further, forcing the programs to rely too heavily on grants and private donations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vandenberg. Are there questions, Mr. Vandenberg? Representative Lehman, David, if you would, please, we have a question for you.
David, were you here when I asked the question of Mr. Donadio?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. About secondary effects. Do you have any comments or any, there? And I don't know if your lobby addresses that issue. I'd kind of like to know how you approach that, or if you ever do analyze net benefits versus maybe area-specific benefits.
Anything that I would have to say to that effect could not really be substantiated, but I think it's generally acknowledged that the net benefits of recycling in terms of energy conservation for a recycled product exceed any environmental damages incurred by the production of the same materials from virgin goods or virgin materials. But like I said, nothing I said I can really prove or bear out. We don't deal in those kinds of that research.
Thank you, Mr. Vandenberg. Next, I'd like to go to Anchorage and ask if Chuck Wingenroth, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Okay, thank you. Could you want me to continue?
Yes, if you would, please state your name for the record and then and who you represent, if you represent an organization, and continue with your testimony.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, my name is Chuck Wengenroth, and I do volunteer work down at the Alaska Center for the Environment. Basically, I'm supporting House Bill 139, particularly as it relates to the schools. The reasons for supporting it are mostly because it instills in the kids reduction in recycling that they're going to carry on for the rest of their lives, which will hopefully eventually cut down on costs for landfills, et cetera. Also, by rewarding them with the funds, it encourages the administrators to help the programs along. And the last thing is, as I remember from school, there was plenty of material available to recycle. That's the end of the comments that I have, and thank you very much for providing me the opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much, Chuck. That brings us to the point where it's time to take action, and I would ask the pleasure of the committee regards House Bill, Committee Substitute House Bill 139. Representative Moyer.
Thank you. I have moved that we move from Committee House Bill 139 CS. Has individual recommendations, ask unanimous consent.
Is there objection? No objection. That means then that House Committee Substitute House Bill 139 Hess moves from the House Resources Committee with individual recommendations. Next, I'd like to continue on with House Bill 143. This would ask the sponsor, Representative McLean, to please come forward. And if you would like to recap or if you have additional comments, Representative, we'd be happy to take those comments at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I would like to do is, with the permission of the committee, is just to offer two amendments. One is a technical amendment to correct an error, and it would be on section 10, page 4, line 8.
Mr. Chairman, do we have
this? Yes. It should be in your black book there. Please continue, Representative McLean.
Okay, and we just delete June 2, 1986 to June 1 and insert June 1, 1986. That's the first technical amendment. The second amendment is on the section that refers to a rule limiting the size of land selections, which appear in DNR's draft regulations for the municipal land program. And this rule was adopted from DNR's mineral leasing program. While having the criteria for determining the size of a selection is not uncommon for a land management agency, most rules are based on an acreage limit rather than a length and width criteria, and always allow some waiver of the rule to be applied. DNR's draft regulations do not allow a waiver, and the governor's administration has opposed this section. So as a compromise, I am willing to amend this section with this amendment number 2. And you should have it within your packets. It's page 3, lines 8 and 9. And you would delete all material and insert the amendment.
Representative Lennon?
I can't, but I don't know that I have an amendment.
And while we're getting the amendment copy for Representative Lumen, a question of the sponsor of the amendment. Did the amendment read then the Commissioner of Natural Resources may not restrain?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Please, did you have a question in Representative Lumen?
No, I'd just like to follow along.
Please continue, Representative McLean.
Okay. Let's see. Those are the two amendments that I would submit to your committee for consideration. And there were some concerns expressed on the wildlife habitat section, and I would like to direct you to sections 4 and 5, where it may alleviate some of the concerns that one of the committee members had expressed. And you can read for yourself sections 4 and 5. What?
Are there committee comments or questions or concerns regarding sections 4 and 5 of the habitat issue? Did you have a
That isn't an amendment.
No.
We have an act on these amendments. I do have concerns as well about that.
Did you have questions at this time?
No.
Okay. Any other questions or concerns? Vice Chairman Lincoln.
Mr. Chairman, is it appropriate at this time to adopt these amendments?
Well, I was going to first hear from the department again.
Okay.
So we will hold the amendments in abeyance until we have a little more testimony. Did you have additional comments, Representative McLean?
No.
Any questions of Representative McLean on House Bill 143? No questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We do have some public testimony and would like to I'd like to go out. Well, first of all, do we have someone from DNR? Carol, did you have any comments or no comments, no questions? But you are available for answering questions. Okay. Are there any questions or comments for the Department of Natural Resources from members of the committee? Diane, did you wish to make further comments regarding this legislation?
I don't have any comments, but I am available for questions. If people have questions either about the administration's position or technical issues related to the bill.
Are there questions of the Department of Community and Regional Affairs regarding House Bill 143? Thank you, Diane. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, forgive me if I asked the same of you last time, but I'm still not satisfied with the answer, I guess. The question that I asked several people had to do with the Northwest Arctic Borough. And whether or not they could meet the suggested conditions by the administration regarding need or community activity need for this additional land, or whether it's just like a land grab because it's there and because others may have come into the been incorporated under these other conditions. And I guess I'm especially interested in the Northwest Arctic Borough because these changes impact it the most. And I'm kind of curious as to what these additional lands, I mean, we're talking about a couple hundred thousand acres of a lot of land, and what these additional lands will do for them, if it means the difference between prosperity or just being able to function as a borough and not. And the answer I've been getting, and maybe it's somewhat unfair because it's probably a detailed question, maybe they're a new borough getting started, but I think it's a question that I'd like to have answered to know if, anyway, I've said enough. Anyway, if you can take a stab at it, I appreciate it.
I'll try to take a stab at it again and again. For the record, I'm Diane Stevens with the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. First off, the section that deals with having to justify additional selections wouldn't just affect the Northwest Arctic Borough. And if you look at the one chart that was on that handout with the administration position, it doesn't have a page number, but it's the chart that sort of sideways talks about municipal entitlement estimates for new boroughs under SSHB 143. Basically, that justification process would require, for example, Denali Borough, if they, if for example we take off the cap and don't have wildlife habitat in the VUU definition, they would have to justify entitlements above 49,400. Any additional entitlements that they want, they'd have to go through that justification process. Same for Lake and Penn Borough, Aleutians East. If they wanted to get entitlements above and beyond, for example, 15,000 for Lake and Penn or 7,600 for Aleutians East, these folks would have to go through this justification process that's proposed in the administration's position. Now, as far as it's hard to predict how this process would work because it's just never been there before. before municipalities who were trying to justify their entitlement justified it to the legislature in 1979. The legislature decided what they thought was fair. They took a cut at it, and that was it. The amount of the entitlement was no longer an issue. It was just decided. And what municipalities had to do was just basically justify where the selections were at within the big state land base. And it's sort of like crystal balling, trying to figure out the way you asked your question was, would the Northwest Arctic Borough be at a hindrance? Would they not be able to operate? It does really tend to get into philosophical questions about what a rural borough would use their land base for, and different philosophies on what timelines they would be on for rural, you know, to develop their lands. Rural boroughs are a lot different than urban boroughs in that the timeline of developing those lands is different for each of the regions of the state. And the commercial fishing economy of the Aleutians Eastboro, the mining economy of Denali, and the subsistence and mixed mining economy of Northwest Arctic Borough will all be on different timelines for how they're going to develop that area. So it would be without knowing what sort of envision by the administration on how much information would the Northwest Arctic Borough have to do to say this land is needed to support the subsistence, recreation, mine economy of the Northwest Arctic Borough. You know, I just don't know. I just can't predict that. I guess it would be everybody's individual judgment as far as how much documentation a borough would have to come in with to justify that, yeah, this land is needed. Yes, we're being hindered by not having it. That's about, I don't know if that's makes it any clearer.
Sure, it's probably about as much as you could be expected to answer, and I know you're on somewhat the other side, I guess, of the issue of the administration. I don't know, it's here someplace in my packet, but the recommendation from the administration that the effective date be changed to sometime in 1987, which my understanding is that would preclude the Northwest Arctic Borough from
right.
from taking advantage of this change, and it probably would be contrary to the intent of the sponsors, since the sponsors representing that area. And so I'd like to hear from somebody in the administration, and maybe we have other people on the line, Mr. Chairman, who can respond to that as to why it would be appropriate to make the change for the Aleutians East, Lake and Peninsula, and Denali boroughs, but it would be inappropriate for the Northwest Arctic Borough. There may be some other reasons that just haven't come out of testimony.
There was the issue of the population cap being retroactive. The different departments had their positions on that early on, and then they had a powwow with the governor's office and state agencies and came out with this administration position that basically it seemed as if the compromise was, okay, let's take off the population cap to a certain extent, but maybe not entirely. And I don't know of any other justification for that other than viewing that as possibly a compromise. I don't know any other basis for that decision.
Additional comments or questions for Ms. Stevens, Representative Carney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I get a little fidgety when I hear the direction of the previous question, because it's my feeling that this entitlement has to do with an economic base for future development, something like money in the bank. And if I'm not mistaken, the city of Anchorage got a cash settlement in lieu of land entitlement. And I dare say that they had plenty of use for that money in the bank. Yeah, like how much was that? Do you know?
I think it was $8 or $9 million. Was the figure stated?
So, they received $8 or $9 million in cash. I have communities in my district who didn't receive any cash when they didn't have any land within their area. So, I'm kind of thinking about an amendment that would allow my communities to get an equivalent amount per capita to what Anchorage got, and I suspect they could figure out a way to use it.
I think that in the statute, it's in Title 29, Section 65, and I can't remember the exact section, but it's called deficiency payment. And I believe in there it just states a figure of $1,000 per acre. And the way it worked in 1979 was that municipality of Anchorage was put into a section of the bill that said, here are the entitlements we're dealing with. There was an acreage amount put next to each of those municipalities. And then this section said, if there's not that land available to meet that, and it had a certain per capita breakout, then that municipality would get $1,000 per acre. That really is in that section that didn't have, that had a deficiency of land and got the payment. I don't know that the, since then there's ever been a legislative session that's ever tried to address it for these other municipalities. There have been instances where the law was amended to allow municipalities who've gotten additional land within their boundaries to now get an entitlement, Anderson being one of those recently that I know of. But certainly that would take some kind of fiscal note, trying to figure out what the financial outfall of that would be to the state, but that's, I'm not sure what that would be.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I was given to understand by someone in research that there were two communities in Alaska. Pelican, I think, was one that got entitlement by virtue of special legislation sometime in the past when they didn't have land within their boundaries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would also note that the city of Apka recently, with it, since 1986, is one of the cities that recently incorporated, and they don't have state land base within their boundaries. And I believe City of False Pass is also one that's sort of a bit overlooked because they're the cities and not the boroughs, but they've recently incorporated since 86.
Thank you.
Additional question, Representative Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, I think just in response to Representative Kearney's comment, I could probably support something along the lines of what he was talking about. If really is shown that there's an inequity in the settlements, and I don't know if the Manuskosukis borough, I think they probably have received land, the city of Palmer is within that borough, but if there's an inequity where that borough has not received its fair compensation, then I could probably support some way to compensate that borough, whether either by additional land or by money. And I'd want to make sure we did that, looked at that, because we have cities, organized cities that are older within existing boroughs that have come along since then, and we have to recognize that the municipality of Anchorage is indeed a unified city and borough. And so we probably, to look at consistency, want to look at the larger borough boundaries.
Additional comments or questions for Ms. Stevens? Thank you very much, Ms. Stevens. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to go to Mr. David Case, who's with the Northwest Arctic Borough. Mr. Case, are you on the teleconference?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
If you would, please state your name for the record, who you represent, and please continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee. My name is David Case, and I'm the attorney for the Northwest Arctic Borough, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 143. Before I get started, perhaps it would do some good and maybe it won't do any harm if I just give you a little briefly some of my background. I'm a lawyer for the borough, but beyond that, I do work widely in rural Alaska. I represent village corporations and governments throughout rural Alaska, and have taught, written about, and negotiated land and resource allocations for the last several years in that context. My clients are almost exclusively rural Alaska institutions. I've been listening to the dialogue here for the last few minutes, and I think it would help us if we could reflect a bit on the constitutional basis for these entitlements and the whole philosophy behind these municipal entitlements. It's difficult for me to know that philosophy and understand why there are questions about why the Northwest Arctic Borough ought to be able to justify this entitlement. NR, for example, in its publication, its analysis of this program in 1990, I've got a couple of clicks on the line. Is it still transmitting?
Yes, we still hear you loud and clear. Please continue, Mr. Case.
The note of the decade left by the federal government and resource exploitation and so forth, a lack of control of the destiny instilled in the drafters of the Alaska Constitution, a vision of what would become the 49th state. And it went on to say that these people were self-reliant and independent, and they decided that they would manifest that philosophy throughout the Constitution. Nowhere are these concepts more evident than in Article 10 of the Constitution, where the relationship between state government and local government is unselfishly defined. And I'd like the committee to remember those words, unselfishly defined. The DNR goes on to say that by offering these incentives, such as these land grants, to encourage municipal incorporations, the state of Alaska furthers the goal of maximum local self-government contained in Article 10. And what we think the 10% entitlement amounts to, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is unselfish definition of the relationship between state and local governments. We're talking about a potentially long festering problem here of defining the relationship between the state government and local governments. Ever since 1963, the standard for the municipal entitlements has been 10% of the vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land within the municipality. That standard was only changed in 1987 with the passage of Chapter 34 of the Statutes of Alaska. And that statute contained a section which specifically related to the Northwest Arctic Borough and characterized the entitlement, the 20-acre per capita entitlement, as a partial entitlement for the borough, and that the full entitlement for the borough was to be to await the completion of the Northwest Area Plan, which is now complete, and the development of a policy of entitlements by the governor. Now, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, you have that policy before you. The policy of the governor is 10%. We agree with that policy. We don't agree. We do not think it is fair. We think it is discriminatory against the Northwest Arctic Borough to say that that policy, which has been the policy of the state since 1963, which is now the policy of the state for all new boroughs, applies to all boroughs except the Northwest Arctic Borough. That is simply unfair. It will, I can assure you, be a source of rancor and continued disbelief within the borough if that policy, in fact, is perpetuated as law. The borough, as I think Mr. Carney said yesterday, this is not a question of retroactivity. It is a question of equity for the borough. If I could respond to some extent to Representative Lehman's questions on this issue. Representative Lehman, I'm in your district in Anchorage. And I can, I guess, perhaps see that coming from a municipal area of the state, we would tend to think that you have to be able to justify where every lot and block is going to be used. And we have an intensive idea of how land is properly used. But for the borough and for rural boroughs, as has been suggested here also, there is a different view of the world. For one thing, we don't have a crystal ball. Nobody here has a crystal ball. We don't know how much land is going to really be necessary for the borough. But then again, neither does the Matanuska-Sisseton borough have a crystal ball. They got 10%. They got over 200,000 acres of land. And if you'll turn to that wall in the back of your committee there and look at that map that's back there behind Representative Carney, you can kind of get an idea of how big the Matanuska-Sisseton borough is and how big the Northwest Arctic borough is. Well, the comparison between these two is, I think, the Matanuska-Sisseton borough is a bit smaller than the Northwest Arctic borough. So 285,000 acres for the Northwest Arctic borough doesn't seem all that extreme to us. We think that the policy ought to be 10%. We ought to begin there. That is the minimum entitlement that a borough ought to have. And one of the things we are dealing with here is there is a number, for the first time in a long time, there are a number of boroughs incorporating. In the past, there have been relatively few boroughs incorporating, and you've sort of been able to make up the rules as you went along. The legislature has had individual boroughs come to them, and they have made individual cuts on the municipal land entitlements. But what this legislation will do is continue the 10% policy, which has been the policy of the state since very early on, and establish uniform rules that are predictable for everybody. And we will not have to be coming back to the legislature every year, spending time to hire people like me to talk about this. We will be able to administratively, even playing field where everybody has the same rules, determine municipal entitlements on a fair and equitable basis. Then I think, Representative Layman, comes the question of whether a municipality can justify a further entitlement. And then I think it makes sense. But the bottom line, the ground floor, is 10%. And if it is not 10%, I suspect that there will be continued political necessity to address this issue borough by borough and almost year by year. I think this bill will go a long way to ending these kinds of continuing and I think unnecessary disputes. Someone said yesterday litigation is welcome to attorneys, but I think that this bill offers ways to avoid litigation and to reduce the costs for municipalities. Now, I guess that's the final point to make, too, is that if you're talking about why a municipality like the Northwest Arctic Borough, how it can justify the need for this 10% of the land within its boundaries, what you're really talking about is substantial cost to the municipality, a new municipality, to do that. You're telling a municipality that when it first starts up, it's going to have to hire staff and lawyers to go fight DNR to get its land entitlement. And it's going to spend years doing that, and it's going to create nothing but bad will and ill will between the state and the local governments. You're going to create the same relationship between the state and its local governments as the state complained about, as is the relationship between itself and the federal government. And we would urge you to avoid that unnecessary battle. We do have concerns about the parcel shape, and I suspect that the amendments that Representative McLean has suggested will address those concerns. The wildlife habitat question is another issue of some concern, although let me point out it is not of concern to the Northwest Arctic Borough. Yesterday, a question was asked of DNR. The answer suggested that the Northwest Arctic Borough was somehow going to benefit by the inclusion of wildlife habitat in the vacant unappropriate underreserved category. That's not the case. The other boroughs, Denali, Lincoln Pin, and the Illusion East will benefit from that change, but not the Northwest Arctic Borough. And that chart that DNR has provided you illustrates that very clearly. The point I think to make, though, about habitat is that often wildlife habitat is a joint classification. It's wildlife habitat and recreation, wildlife habitat and mineral development or something. And there's a lot of wildlife habitat. It's often jointly classified. But the bill, of course, will protect critical habitat, and that, we think, is the real issue. No, we're not suggesting that critical habitat ought to be open to municipal selections. If wildlife habitat, furthermore, the adjudication process that this bill lays out will enable DNR to reject wildlife habitat selections if they are deemed to be important or reclassify them if necessary as critical habitat to preclude selection. In any case, we think that the best interest determination set out in Sections 4 and 5 of the bill will address quite adequately the wildlife habitat question and will make additional lands necessary for the available to the boroughs within the 10% range. Finally, we think this bill, as I've suggested, also incorporates policies and processes which will bring regularity, predictability, to this whole process and will generate a system that is fair to municipalities and will keep the cost down for determining these entitlements. One of the ways it will do that, it will involve the DCRA, the Department of Community Regional Affairs, in a consultative role. It will allow for the mediation, not the litigation of disputes to begin with, but mediation of disputes. And we think that's a very useful way for state and municipal governments to cement their relationships, to grow together, to develop cooperatively, is to mediate disputes rather than to cast them immediately into courts and into the tender hands of me and my colleagues. We exercise of the Department of Natural Resources discretion, the adjudication of these matters, and it will reduce the potential disputes that exist. We are concerned that DNR does make decisions, and this is not really addressing the bill at this point, but that the DNR does make decisions which co-opt, preempt municipal land selections and land planning decisions that are made by municipalities. While lands are selected by municipalities, DNR will often or sometimes dispose of them to other uses, such as leases and the like, and that can frustrate municipal land planning. We think that the DNR ought to be sensitive to those things, and that that the statutes and regulations ought to preclude disputes between municipal governments and the state whenever possible. We think the bill does that and accomplishes those results, and we think, as Representative Carney has suggested in his final matter, that this is a question of equity at the bottom. It's also a question of redeeming the promise of the Alaska Constitution and this of the Alaska Legislature in 1987 as far as the Northwest Arctic Borough is concerned, and we would urge your support for House Bill 143. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Case. Questions for Mr. Case, Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate getting a chance to talk to Mr. Case after the last meeting. I think I understand your arguments about equity in talking about the population requirements. But if you apply that argument to the wildlife habitat issue or the parcel size, doesn't that make the case that we'd be setting up one set of rules for one set of municipalities when there was a different set for the others?
I guess I don't think so. But the point is that even if that were the case, if the rule is wrong in the first place, then it's no sense in perpetuating it. There's two parts to the answer to that question, I think. First is to the 4-to-1 ratio. That ratio was established, as I understand it, for mining claims. Those are small claims, relatively small claims of land. I have substantial doubts whether that's a good idea when we're dealing with municipal land selections, which often result in hundreds or thousands of acres of land selections. We're not saying that there could be no parcel sizes limitations. I guess we think that DNR has some discretion to establish to determine that, or we don't think it should be an arbitrary 4-to-1 classification. We don't think that really accommodates the access requirements, for example, as Diane Stevens mentioned at the last hearing, for municipalities such as these rural boroughs. Now, the 4-to-1 may have worked too in areas where you had denser populations, but we see reasons that it does not work in areas where you do not have dense populations. The other point on wildlife habitat, the question of what is BUU land has changed over time. I mean, that has been a category of land that has changed, and municipal selections have been allowed over time for larger and different classifications that were at one time precluded from selection. And we're just saying that this represents another question of allowing municipal selections for a different kind of classification. Now, I can understand it, Representative Finkelstein, if the concern was for some kind of carefully identified or clearly identified critical habitat that was necessary for wildlife propagation. And that's precluded by this bill. It's also precluded by the adjudication process DNR will go through to determine to adjudicate a land selection. I think that DNR could determine that it is not in the best interest, under the terms of this bill, to allow a municipality to select a particular piece of wildlife land, and that if justified could preclude it. So I don't see that there's a necessity, since so much land is classified as wildlife and something else together, that it's necessary to preclude municipal selections of all wildlife habitat land.
Mr. Chairman, I
please continue.
Yeah, that you just restated the reasoning behind your positions, and while I appreciate them, you did mention them before. The only point I was making is that you're asking for equity on one hand, in a case where it benefits you, but when it comes to equity with the treatment of the other municipalities, you, you're asking to not have equity, and I think that's the point I'm making. The other question I had is you raised on wildlife habitat the one of the problems that I wasn't aware of. I'm glad you brought it up, the problem of joint classification, that municipalities can be precluded from selecting in areas where an area is classified for both agriculture and wildlife habitat or something like that. I guess if we get a chance later, I'd like to ask the department if that's actually the case. But if it is the case, would that address your concerns over wildlife habitat to somehow say that in cases where a joint classification was to occur and one of them was wildlife habitat, then in those cases the selections would be allowed?
It may, Representative Eaglesine, Mr. Chairman, but let me say again, I guess I don't want to get too far along here, because this is not a problem for the Northwest Arctic Borough. Our selections, for one reason or another, do not include wildlife habitat. But it is of concern, perhaps, for the newly formed boroughs for Lake and Penn and Denali and Aleutians East.
Well, I realize, and I'm mostly asking just because of your familiarity with municipalities in general. That's all.
Right. Well, I guess I think that may go to resolve the problem to the extent that it indicates that there is some uncertainty about how this land should really be classified. Perhaps it would.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Additional questions for Mr. Case? Representative Lehman?
Thank you, Chairman. Dave, I think you might have overreacted a little bit to my line of questions. I was more trying to solicit information than to, I think, to state a position. And if you were at the meeting last Tuesday, I think I stated at that meeting that I am supportive of whatever measures we can to get some of these EU lands that are in state ownership into local control, and I would encourage that where it's appropriate, especially where you need to do that to be equitable. The question I have for you is, you have a pretty good background in this and a lot better history in this than I do, and having worked in the area. Do you know if all of the organized boroughs in the state have received either their 10% entitlement or equivalent cash?
I don't know if they all have, Representative Lehman.
With the exception of yours.
It is true of the municipality of Anchorage, and my understanding of it is, and perhaps it's imperfect, is that there have sort of been borough by borough, as the issues have come up, they have gone back to the legislature to be resolved. To my knowledge, Anchorage is the only one that has received cash, but I could well be wrong about that. The 10% entitlement has been frustrated in the urban boroughs and in many of them, if not all of them, because there, by the time they were formed, there was very little state land in them in the first place, and so they the entitlement and then of course it was a moving target too. It became entitled at one time, but then the law changed, and your time for your selection changed, and you might have had the entitlement at one time, but by the time you got selected, it wasn't there, and there were a number of confusions that had to be addressed by the legislature. So I guess I don't know the answer to that question as far as 10% or equivalence for cash. Perhaps someone from GNR can answer.
Okay, can you just refresh my memory? I'm sure we went through this before, but why, and Willie Hensley might have mentioned it last Tuesday, but why was the 20-acre cap put on? My understanding is that it was put on in 1978, I guess, in just before, or no, it put on in 78, and I don't know if any other boroughs were subject to this cap or have been affected by it, or if only your borough or the Northwest Arctic Borough and the other three new ones have been affected by it, and if so, why was that cap put on at the time? And do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, I'm not sure I really do. I think it was a political compromise, and it was not in 1978, it was in 1987 that the cap was imposed, that was because at that time the 20-acre per capita cap happened to coincide with the 10% policy would eliminate the cap for the three new ones, that would leave only the Northwest Arctic Borough that is not that is stuck with and left with 20 acre per capita cap.
Thank you very much.
Additional questions for Mr. Case? Thank you very much, Mr. Case. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'd like to call on Rick Weibel and Anderson. Are you there, Mr. Weibel?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please give your name for the record, who you represent, and continue with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Weibel, and I'm a member of the Denali Borough Assembly, as well as chairman of the borough's Land Use Planning Committee. I have also served for over 10 years on the Land Use Planning Commission for the city of Anderson, where I participated fully in the Westport settlement process to the extent that it occurred there. I sent my testimony in last week, so I will only make a few additional comments. I mostly want to talk about land classification. All state land within the Denali Borough was given some type of classification 5 years ago under the Denali Basin Area Plan, well before this borough came into being. By looking at the map, you can see a disproportionately large area designated as wildlife habitat, suggesting that this is a catch-all classification. While no one disputes that critical wildlife habitat should remain under state ownership, we argue that wildlife habitat is rightfully classified as vacant, unappropriated, and undeserved. This is a crucial matter for this borough and affects our long-term viability. Reclassification brought up at an earlier hearing does not seem like a workable option because of the time constraints and because most of the recent reclassifications have tended to be more rather than less restrictive. The other major problem, particularly from the perspective of the city of Anderson, is the lack of funding for implementation of some physical land from Anderson. The DNR's adjudication process ground to a halt in July of 1989 and remains dead in the water since the line item veto has occurred. If House Bill 143 undergoes any changes, we feel that DNR's ultimate performance of conveyance should be addressed. Completion of Anderson's entitlement as well as all of the borough. Finally, we feel that further administrative or departmental delays in this process seem intolerable. We no need to wait for additional conveyance of federal land, at least in the Denali Borough's case, and would simply ask for the option to proceed in a straightforward and timely manner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weibel. Next, are there questions, Mr. Weibel? No questions. Next, I'd like to go to Jeff Smith in Katsubina. Mr. Smith, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Jeff Smith. I'm a member of the Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly. I don't want to take up too much of the committee's time. I'll just make a few comments. One, I was involved in the 1987 legislation, and to not include the retroactive clause would make us an exception. To pass the bill as it is soon to be amended, will treat us just like the boroughs before us and the boroughs after us. We agreed with the administration that if they wanted to relook at the municipal land entitlement policy, we would allow them to do that. They've done it. They still maintain that the 10% is appropriate. We certainly agree with that and think that our borough should be included. The other item I'd like to respond to is we are going to be making these decisions over the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years, and it's going to be very difficult for municipalities to conceive of what is going to be here then. I maintain that even 10 years ago, we would have probably all been surprised to talk about a world-class lead zinc mine in Northwest Alaska that would be operating in the year 1991. We're here, and it's a fact. We do have a world-class lead zinc mine. We do not know what it's going to be like in 2001. I think it would be very difficult and harmful to require municipalities to give the justification now when we don't know what it's going to be like. But if the land entitlement was important to the boroughs formed in the 60s, it is absolutely critical formed and have been formed in the 80s and the 90s. We do not have very many economic opportunities, and these municipal land entitlements are going to be the one area where we're going to have the financial wherewithal to take on the responsibilities of local government. And I'll be glad to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Questions to the gentleman from Kotzebue. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, I think you've probably been online and you've heard some of the questioning, and one of the comments that was made just a little while ago dealt with the issue of the moving target. I think Mr. Case brought it up, the moving target where there weren't as much state lands available when some of the older boroughs were formed. And so this has been changing, and then, you know, the target has actually been shifting. And so if we're looking at equity, you know, it may be appropriate to go back and reconsider that. I don't know that it is. I don't know that it isn't. When you were down here with DCRA, did you ever look at that, and have you thought about that at all when you've been tackling this issue?
Yes, sir. We've looked at this issue. We spent a great deal of time on this issue when I was with the Sheffield administration at DCRA, and I know that the department's continued to look at it. What the moving target has really been is the definition of U land. And we would probably, and I think all the other bros would agree with me, we'd go with the definition of U lands that existed in the 60s when the first bros were formed, than the definition of U lands in the 90s when the other boroughs are formed. So while there are some concerns of equity, I think the real serious concerns of equity are the municipalities that were not fortunate enough to have state land selections within their boundaries. And I'm not sure exactly how you deal with that, but that's really the only issue of equity that we found.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jeff.
Additional questions? No questions. Then I'd like to come back to Juneau and ask Mr. David Vandenberg for his testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? No one here. Is there anyone in the teleconference who wishes to testify on House Bill 143? Did we catch everybody? So go ahead, Mr. Vandenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for allowing me to testify again on HB 143. The Alaska Environmental Lobby has reservations regarding HB 143. Though many of these reservations have already been noted and addressed in forms of amendments and conversation, we believe at least three of these provisions threaten the state's management practices and the environmental and the integrity of the region's environment. Our reservations include, first, the inclusion of wildlife habitat in the view lands. Second, the conditions on regulations to restrict shape of parcels. We believe that selecting non-compact, non-contiguous, oddly shapen land parcels invites management problems and access difficulties. Third, absence of environmental language. There's nothing in HB 143 that provides any environmentally assuring language. Presumably, municipal uses would differ from the current land uses or land management uses now, and there's no contingency plan to provide for remedies of potential damages incurred by land uses and none to remedy potential impacts to adjoining state lands resulting from municipal uses. And thank you very much. This concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vandenberg. Are there questions of Mr. Vandenberg? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
That brings us to the amendments.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Finkelstein.
I have some questions that came out of testimony for DNR. I've got four questions.
Ms. Wilson, would you like to come forward, please, as a representative of DNR?
Do we have anyone to shoot from? Someone get pretty detailed. Do we have anyone from Land and Water as well?
There's no one available on teleconference or here from the department, but would you like to try these questions, Ms. Wilson?
I'll certainly give it a try.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Representative Finkelstein, your questions.
Well, we had some discussion earlier in the testimony on what the power of the department is to allow selections or to disallow selections within these precluded within these allowed categories. Someone said a department can disallow selections even though lands are listed on the list of agricultural, grazing, material, public recreation, all these land classifications, that even though a selection is made there, the department could disallow it for feelings it wasn't in the state interest. And I'm not familiar enough with the process to know how that's done.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finkelstein, there's, as far as I understand it, two stages. That with the basic entitlement, if the land has been classified, certain classifications are selectable. So the basic entitlement of the municipality, they could select out of the classifications like settlement and so on that are available. With the governor's policy, above the basic entitlement, a municipality could look at certain categories of lands and want to select them. If the classification wasn't correct, we would have to change that classification. But in any case, we'd have to do a best interest finding, saying whether or not it was in the best interest of the state to give them the extra land.
Right, and I think that's a good point as to the, you know, why there's already an ability to get to some of these lands. But the question I was asking wasn't that, it's the reverse. If a selection's allowed already, say on public recreation or grazing material lands, it's allowed, what's the department's power to disallow that selection? Someone said on the testimony that the department can already do that, can decide that it isn't in the state interest, even though it's one of the allowed categories. And I'm not familiar enough with law to know where that is.
We would still do a best interest finding because under 3805, I believe it's 035, before you could dispose of an interest in state land, you must determine it's in the best interest of the state to do so.
So you could turn down a portion of it based on that if you felt like the category was inappropriate?
If it was in the public's interest.
Okay. The second question I had was about the questions on joint classification. If the land is classified jointly as material sites or wildlife habitat or agriculture and wildlife habitat, are those considered to be an open category or closed category for selections?
I'm not positive about that in terms that I didn't bring our book that describes land classifications, but I believe anything with wildlife habitat is closed because I think that's the primary use. Some of our classifications have a primary use and secondary uses and so on.
Okay. The third question I had is on the way that this changed the impact of this wildlife habitat. I think I remember Gus saying last week that it comes in two ways. One is by including wildlife habitat, you increase the acreage available for the original determination of entitlement, and then two, you allow a bigger base for the actual selections themselves once the entitlement is determined. Is that correct in your understanding?
Yes, because the VUU description, what 10% of VUU land is the basic municipal entitlement. And so if you suddenly included wildlife habitat within that VUU, then 10% of a bigger number would be a bigger entitlement.
Okay, my last question is on the, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the amendment, but the part that relates to the size selection category, I'm having a hard time understanding what the impact to the department's process is going to be of the first sentence. Do you have any feeling on what that first sentence is going to mean?
Give me a
second. First sentence that says, may not restrict the shape or selection without considering. It goes into a list.
I'm not certain what the effect would be. It looks like it probably gives us some leeway to restrict, but right now, the way the policy is that we've established, we would be doing essentially this by, we could change the 4-to-1 if we thought it was in the best interest of the public. So that if there were municipal interests and there were public interests, we'd have to weigh both of those. This doesn't really talk about the overall public interest, I think would be my biggest concern. But without reading it closely and really studying it, I really couldn't say.
Great, thank you. Thank you for that. Appreciate your help.
Carol, I'll just take that.
Additional comments or questions by members of the committee on House Bill 143. Representative Lehman.
Thanks, Chairman. Carol, could you give me a succinct reason after hearing this discussion from these other people regarding equity? Could you give me a succinct reason that the administration opposed
opposes an effective date in 1986 and rather supports one in 1987, which would preclude the Northwest Arctic Borough from coming in under this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can make it very succinct, but let me try. In terms of the Northwest Arctic Borough, the 1987 compromise essentially established a number for the Northwest Arctic Borough, that 20-acre cap, 20-acre per capita entitlement, that made it equal pretty much the average for all other municipalities statewide, and that average was certainly distorted by the Mapsu Borough. But that made the Northwest Arctic boroughs basically equal to what happened with the other boroughs, so that we believe there is equity so far. When the discussion came up with the Department of Community and Region Affairs about the 20-acre cap, Community and Regional Affairs believed that this was perhaps an impediment to the formation of new boroughs, that this would be seen as, gee, that's going to hurt us, so it might keep someone, some borough from forming. They wanted the cap lifted. The agencies all agreed that, well, we don't want to keep new boroughs from forming. It's certainly in the best interest of the state to see these boroughs form. So that's where the discussion of removing the cap came from. It was always existing boroughs should stay the way they are. Now, what happened to these three boroughs that have just formed, that really haven't received their land, were caught in the middle. And when we looked at that chart that's attached to our policy, everybody said, well, it would only be one borough that had a different amount, and that was the Denali Borough for 9,000 acres. And so it seemed like for those three boroughs, it didn't really make a difference. That was the compromise. 9,000 acres is not a great amount.
Do you have a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman?
I guess I might just vote as long as Carol's here. Carol, do you know anything about the economic viability of this new Denali borough, as to whether that 9,000 acres would make a significant difference in its ability to function or ability to have land and use it for community needs or not?
No, I do not.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilson. Are there other comments or questions by members of the committee regarding House Bill 143? If not, that brings us down to three amendments. The first one I will call number one is the June amendment, we'll call it number one. That is the one that deletes June 2nd and inserts June 1. Number two is going to be the second amendment offered by Representative McLean, which is to delete all material and insert on page 3, 8, and 9. And then amendment 3 will be the suggestion by Representative Hudson the last time we discussed this bill, which was to insert and make every effort on page 2, line 8, I believe.
Yes.
Line 4, I'm sorry. And I'd just like to put the committee on notice. I will go ahead at this time and agree to act on Representative Hudson's amendment, but after this, I will not take amendments that are not in writing. So just for future reference, I think we'll play it safe and make sure that it is in writing. So amendment number one.
Mr. Chairman,
I have Representative Finkelstein.
I don't have any amendments in writing either, but I do have some amendments that are easy to understand.
So. Okay, maybe if you want to jot them out, and I'd like to get them around to the,
we've been discussing them throughout this hearing, so I think it's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'd be glad to try to run down.
Well, I just want to make sure we know exactly what we're considering.
I think we'll be good.
Okay, but we should have something that we can pass out to the committee. And will it take quite a while, you think? Or?
No, just keep going.
Okay, good. Vice Chairman Lincoln.
I move for amendment number one.
It's been moved to adopt amendment number one that deletes June 2 and inserts June 1. Is there objection to amendment number one? No objection to amendment number one. Amendment number one is adopted. Amendment number two is what is the pleasure of the committee regarding amendment number two offered by Representative McClain, the prime sponsor. Representative Finkelstein.
Mr. Chairman, my problem with it is the first sentence. I don't really understand it.